Hi, pals. This is Duncan Trussell, and you're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. I'm not going to do any kind of opening monologue because I'm on this Tim Ferriss 4-hour workout body diet and haven't been eating any cupcakes and cakes, so I'm going into some kind of sugar withdrawal, and I feel weird, and I don't think that I can really talk about much of anything except for the fact that I desperately want to shove a stack of pancakes in my face and wash it down with some Belgian beer. I feel grumpy and lightheaded. Sucks. Typical pig. Just a typical little pink little pig who's not getting his slop. That's how bad it's gotten. I just want to shove candied apples into my mouth. I want to lay in a pit of candied apples and donuts and bread and cakes, creams, and Sizzler ice cream bars. Fuck. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to win. It's only been 3 days. And I already feel like throwing a Molotov cocktail into a baby carriage. The Duncan Trussell Family Hour is sponsored by Shore Design T-Shirts. Shore Design T-Shirts is a fantastic company that exists in Thailand. Their T-Shirts have been compared in softness to the softness of the ice cream at Sizzler. A Shore Design T-Shirt is the candied pretzel of T-Shirts. Shore Design T-Shirts are like a bowl of Ben & Jerry's ice cream, sweet and cold on a hot summer's day. Nothing wrong with one or two little bites of a Shore Design T-Shirt if it was ice cream. Shore Design T-Shirts are the M&Ms of T-Shirts. Shore Design T-Shirts are better than some dumb old book written by a goddamn mutant who's managed to strip away all his body fat and transform into some kind of super athlete by not eating anything good. Shore Design T-Shirts are better than any kind of philosophy coming from the mouth of a demon who's wrenched the donuts from the mouth of every fat person in America and replaced it with jerky. Shore Design T-Shirts are better than anything that would make a person avoid fruit. Shore Design T-Shirts, if you want to know what it's like to wear an ice cream bar, then go to ShoreDesignT-Shirts.com and check out all these awesome shirts. Beautiful designs, the kind of designs that you see on expensive candy bar packages. Just check them out. The shirts are incredible. They're very, very soft. And sometimes maybe being soft is better than being hard. Having hard muscles or a hard body. Maybe there's something nice about having a nice, soft little layer of chub. Shore Design T-Shirts. Go to ShoreDesignT-Shirts.com and put my name in and you will get 10% off of these awesome shirts. Do go check them out. I'm just joking, of course. Check out the website. And they support this podcast. They print all our shirts. And Bennett over there is a wonderful man. So go to ShoreDesignT-Shirts.com. Check it out. We're also sponsored by Audible.com. Audible features some of the greatest audiobooks out there. I believe you can even download the 4-hour body if you want to experience what it's like to wander into the depths of hell for a month at the cost of all human happiness and joy. If you want to hear a book that was created by probably a ringwraith, then go there. I'm doing it. Experience this with me. Audible.com. They've got a lot of great audiobooks. Go to audibletrial.com/familyhour and you will get a free download of an audiobook if you sign up for a trial membership. That's pretty awesome. These audiobooks will keep you on the treadmill, which doesn't really matter if you're on a treadmill if you can't stop eating donuts and breads. But check it out. Maybe there's a book there that'll distract you from the feeling of your body screaming for sugar in the same way a filthy street urchin underneath some underpass screams for meth. Why don't they have methadone for sugars? Someone answer that question. Are there any nutritionists out there? I need to talk to you. I'm clearly doing something wrong here. Audible trial/family hour. Sign up for it. They give us $15 and that's awesome. There are other ways you can support the podcast. You can go to duncantrussell.com and sign up for the forum. You can, if you're an Amazon shopper and you're going to buy something on Amazon, if you go to duncantrussell.com, there's an Amazon portal that you can click through, and we get 7% of anything that you buy from Amazon. So that's another cool way you can support this podcast. And to all of you who have been donating and posting on the forum and sending me stuff to the P.O. box, thank you very much. Please, whatever you do, do not send me any kind of sugars. Don't send me boxes of cookies, because I would feel like I had to eat them out of respect for you. The Duncan Trussell Family Hour is pleased to welcome back to the show Dr. Chris Ryan. Dr. Chris Ryan is the author of an amazingly interesting book called Sex at Dawn. If you haven't read it, you should definitely read it. It's a book that sort of looks at monogamy from an evolutionary perspective, and it's incredibly interesting, incredibly incendiary, and also ultimately is very guilt-relieving if you've been wondering why sometimes you're in a long-term relationship, you think about straying, or if you've ever been cheated on and experienced what that's like. It'll give you a kind of genetic explanation for why people often cheat on each other, and maybe it'll help you undemonize someone that you've turned into a demon, or even better, make you feel a little less awful if you've fooled around and feel like some kind of swamp beast when really you just listened a little closely to the compulsion of your DNA. So check out the book Sex at Dawn, which is available through Amazon and is also available through Audible. So you can get the audiobook version of it. And now, everyone, please send out your love energy to embrace world explorer, brilliant writer, and one of my favorite people on planet Earth, Dr. Chris Ryan. Dr. Christopher Ryan, welcome back. How are you?
The doctor's in the house.
Yeah, what have you been up to, man?
I've been running my ass off. I was in Vancouver all summer, enjoying clean air, clean water. Have you been to Vancouver?
Yes, I have. I'm heading up there actually in a few weeks to do stand-up.
That's right. I told my friends. They're all going to go see
Oh, cool. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah, love it. I was working on developing a TV show with a guy named Pete McCormick, who recently directed I Am Bruce Lee,
okay,
record-breaking documentary. And then before that, he did a thing called Facing Ali, a beautiful film about guys who fought Muhammad Ali.
Ugh.
Yeah, yeah, that is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. Even if you're not into boxing or necessarily into Muhammad Ali, which I don't know anyone who isn't, but
yeah,
if you're that one person, it's a great film because it's about, you go into a thing and it's about like tough guys and box. He interviewed, like, he's got Joe Frazier crying, talking about Muhammad Ali, how he feels when he sees Ali now, and
right,
and you know, and these guys, like, they're talking about fighting Ali as a life-changing event for them. Almost all of them got their asses kicked, of course. But, you know, Ali picked people out of obscurity for his tune-up fights to give him a break.
Wow.
You know, they get him $500,000 for some unknown hunk to get in the ring with Ali. That changes your life, you know?
Do you think that is... Because I've noticed that more often than not in legends, they all seem to be really generous and they seem to help underdogs, or am I just hoping that's the way it is? Because it does seem to, the people who like that have this altruistic tendency.
Well, they're definitely, you know, they're not angry. Angry boxers don't do well. You know, it's a sport, and they go in there wanting to win, of course, and they get all hyped up, but With the exception of the situation with Joe Frazier, you don't sense that there's a lot of animosity, that these guys really admire Ali,
right,
and always have and always will. With Joe Frazier, there was a lot of weird stuff going on, sort of racism, actually, you know, between the light-skinned black guy and the dark-skinned black guy. Ali said Frazier was the gorilla. He called him the gorilla, right? Imagine if a white opponent called Joe Frazier the gorilla.
Jesus.
Know? And he went around with, he had a little gorilla doll he would hold up in press conferences and shit. But anyway, so I was working with Pete McCormick developing a TV show, and now I'm here in Hollywood pitching the TV show.
Have you already started pitching?
No, Pete's editing the sizzle reel as we speak, so it'll go out early October.
Can you talk about the show at all?
Sure. The show's called Sex Drive, Turn on the Truth. And the idea is it's going to be a TV show where I look at sexuality and all its magnificence and strangeness with absolutely no fear of offending anyone, trying to find that sweet spot where it's fun and funny, but not silly and juvenile.
Right.
And intellectually serious without being dusty and professorial. So
right.
It's like,
that is a tightrope, brother.
Well, you know, it's. I mean, the reason Pete wanted to do it with me is he read Sex.
Because what you just described,
right,
is you. That's your voice. You pull it off because some, you know, like for example, no offense to anyone over there, but sometimes you turn on Playboy Radio, and when they're talking about sex, the way they're doing it is in that kind of like repressed reaction, or the reaction towards repression that comes out like, oh yeah, oh my God, what a beautiful pussy you have. You know what I mean? That weird contrived vocal quality, that tonality that indicates sexiness, that just seems so fake and not what it is at all.
Yeah. Well, I make no, what's the word? I have no illusions about being sexy. Right, I am not going to be the sexy host of a sex show.
don't denigrate yourself like that.
Well, if there's anything sexy about me, it's my brain and my voice.
That's sexy.
Yeah. Okay. But in other words, I'm not going to be the guy saying, "Look at the cock on that." No, that's not me.
That voice, by the way, sounds more like it would come out of some orc in Mordor than "Look at that cock. Bring me the cock on a platter."
I must have the cock. Why is it that all those shows they end up with British accents?
What do you mean
Well, like Game of Thrones.
All right.
Okay, they're in some fantasy world. How come everyone in the fantasy world speaks with a British accent?
That's a fantastic question. I wish I could answer that. It doesn't make any sense. It's like on an alternate planet. I think it's got different moon. It's got clearly something's fucking up with the sun, because the thing gets long winters happen, which indicates some terrible climate problem happening there. So they're definitely not on some distant earth.
Yeah.
I guess it's just easy.
Yeah. Well, I think it has a medieval feel. Oh. So anything medieval gets Britishized somehow.
I want to ask you about that. How filthy was sex in medieval times?
Everything was filthy in medieval times. Everything. I mean, the reason spices, where the whole spice trade, you know, and the pepper from India and all the exploration, the whole thing that was going on with the spice. Do you know why spice was so fucking important?
No fridges.
They were eating, they were eating rotten meat. Ugh. Rotten, you know, disgusting maggot-filled meat.
Ugh.
And if you put a bunch of spices on it, it tasted a little better. Same thing with perfume. You know, perfume, the whole industry of perfume began in the Middle Ages in France, I believe, where people were not bathing. They actually thought that water was toxic, and so you want to bathe as little as possible, once, twice a year max. So you use the perfume to cover up the stench.
So this is to me, when I think about Game of Thrones, and I see those sex scenes, my mind is thinking, no way, dude. When these people aren't showering, right? That is not what sex. What do you think sex was extended in the Middle Ages? Where do you think people were like sucking each other off and like doing that kind of stuff back then, or was it just so rancid that you just wouldn't do it because it was just so foul?
Good question.
No toilet paper, no water. How did they wipe their asses?
Well, there was water, of course.
But would they use water to clean their asses?
I don't know, actually. You know who you should interview is my friend Tony Perrotet, who's an expert in the sort of history of sexuality. He wrote about the Naked Olympics, and he's written books about the medieval period. And his last book, what was it called? The Pervert's Tour, The Pervert's World Tour, something like that.
That's cool.
Yeah. I should ask him. I'll see him next week. I'll ask him, how did people wipe their asses in the Middle Ages?
It's an important question.
It is. Well, I'm going to be doing a workshop at Esalen in a few weeks. And one of the things I'm going to ask, I don't know when this is going to go out, but I'm going to ask my attendees is to take a shit in their hand.
That is not a good sell. Are you trying to get people to come there? Because that's not the first thing you want on your pamphlet.
Okay, and if you don't want to, you can shit in your hat. I mean, you shit wherever you want. But the idea of, you know, why is it that something that's inside your body, the minute it comes out of your body, it's suddenly disgusting and you can't bear to touch it? You've been touching it its entire existence, you know?
Right.
And I'm not saying I'm immune to it. If I spit into a glass and then try to drink my own spit, that's kind of disgusting.
Well, yeah. Meanwhile, though, if you chew gum, all you're doing is flavoring your spit. Like, that's just flavored spit. Gum is spit flavoring, right? There's not, like, some extra water coming out of your mouth when you're chomping a piece of gum.
Right.
It's like if you spit in a glass and filled it up with the amount of spit that's generated through gum and then put flavoring in it, it's the same drink.
You know what I love about this? That your listeners know this is not prepared material. You just go into your spit-flavored gum routine purely spontaneously. Yeah. Never been aired before.
No, I've thought about it, though. When I'm chomping gum, I have been like, my God, what are you doing? You're just drinking your own peppermint-flavored spit.
But you drink it anyway.
Yeah, but something about... Exactly. This is so... I suppose it's like what you're doing here is you're playing around with conditioning or you're playing around with...
Yeah, exactly. Cultural conditioning.
Right.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I don't know if you've been in Asia. I spent a large part of my life...
I went to India.
Okay. So, in India, you wipe your ass with your left hand.
Yes.
A little bit of water, right?
Yes.
Now, were you there long enough to get used to that?
You know, I had a conversation with an Indian guy in Dharamsala, and he was a really cool guy. You know how in India you'll just run into somebody and you could end up spending the afternoon with them. Like, sure. You just end up talking, and they're so cool, man. And so, like, we just got in this nice conversation, and specifically about the issue of wiping your ass with your hand. And at the time, I was in college and I hadn't really put a lot of thought into it. And I was like, I don't know, man. It just seems gross. And he's like, if I put a piece of shit on your face, would you wipe it off with a Kleenex? And it's like, you know what I mean? It's like, no, man, I would wash it. I'd scrub it.
Yeah.
So he's like, in the same way, if you've got shit anywhere in your body, why are you just using a Kleenex to get rid of it or a tissue? Why wouldn't you use water and solvent to scrub it off and then wash your hands so that they're really clean?
Right, yeah. And I think of that in terms of barbecue, right? You go to a barbecue, you get the barbecue sauce on your fingers, the ribs or whatever, right? And then you wipe your hands with a dry paper towel.
Right.
Right? Right. No matter how well you wipe them, you're not getting that barbecue sauce completely off there.
That's right.
So the idea that wiping your ass with a wet hand is better than a dry paper is completely illogical. Makes no sense factually at all. And yet, you know, you talk to most Westerners and they're convinced that they're doing it the right way.
You mean wiping your ass with a paper is better than a wet hand?
I'm saying a wet hand is better.
I thought you were saying, okay, yeah, gotcha.
It's like washing your hands in water is going to work better than wiping them off with a wet paper.
Totally, man. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is a plague in the West. Dirty assholes. It's like this fucking culture is filled with dirty assholes. It's like the final remnant of the Middle Ages, isn't it?
There we go.
We're treating our assholes like people treated their bodies in the Middle Ages. It's, like, water's toxic.
There you go, man.
You got to scrub that fucking thing.
Yeah. Well, not scrub it. I mean, you don't want to
scrub it for hours and hours.
Who was it? Somebody was telling me a story they had never seen. Oh, it was a guy from Asia. We were talking about this. I think he was from India, and it was his first. He came to, like, England or somewhere to go to college, and he saw the toilet brush, and he had never seen a toilet brush before, and he thought it was for scrubbing his ass after he
shot. Oh, no. That hurt. Yeah. That fucking hurt.
I wouldn't want it. But, all right, have we grossed out your audience enough?
Oh, I don't think we want to stay here. I don't think we've grossed them out. I mean, I think we just started hitting upon a very important point, which is the idea of how much of what we consider disgusting or revolting
right.
is disgusting and revolting because of some survival mechanism or some genetic predisposition to not get sick or poison right. ourselves, and how right. much of it is there because our parents were fucking assholes.
And well, all right, a little less aggressive toward our parents or our culture. You know, the culture, it's very arbitrary. I do this in the beginning of Sex at Dawn. We talk about food, right? Like, why is it disgusting to eat insects, but completely cool to eat lobsters and shrimp? They're right. insects.
Right.
It's the same thing. Exoskeleton, you know, white, glunky, you know, whatever. I mean, lobsters in early American history were considered the food, like the garbage food, right?
Right.
Nobody, there were laws against feeding your servants lobster more than 3 or 4 days per week.
Wow.
You could not give them lobster every day. That was unfair to them.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Right? So it's just like, it's all whatever's available, you know, the whole value, supply, demand thing. That happens independently of any real question of nutritional value or fat content or, you know, health effects or any of that, you know? So now there are people farming lobsters, micro grazing, they call it. Or not lobsters, insects.
Oh, yeah.
It's I think it's going to happen, you know, because there's no methane, there's no, you know, cow farts.
You mean you're going to be able to order, like, a bowl of bugs at a restaurant?
Yeah, there are places here in L.A. that supply live worms, crickets, all sorts of stuff.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because if you take a lobster and you look at that fucking thing, that is not something that looks appetizing. That is a scary beast. I mean, if you've eaten delicious lobster, then you know it's good.
Yeah.
But when you set eyes on the thing, you wouldn't be like, yeah, let's crack that open to eat it.
Right.
So I understand what you mean with this level of conditioning. And it goes into everything. And it's really annoying, man. It's kind of a curse that hangs over everyone, isn't it? It's like this sense that you can't, that there's certain activities that are considered to be just awful, and right. and the shame that's generated from it, which right. is something I love about your book, and something I love about what you're doing is it's a kind of like you're like a shame exorcist, you know. I think it's it's cool, you know, because people need that. Yeah. People need to. I just went to this. I actually texted you about this to see if you wanted to go. I just went to this fetish party, and it's been a while since I've been to one of those things. And I was immediately reminded of something I'd forgotten, which is that the energy at those places is so positive and happy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, people there are really sweet and cool and kind of loving in a certain way.
Almost the opposite of what you expect going into it for the first time, or at least for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're uninitiated, you sort of expect that kind of scene to be like real, you know, porn.
Yeah.
Nasty.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of, I'm going to fuck you. And you go in there and they're like, hi, how are you? My name's Anada. And let me introduce you and let me show you around. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
You people are nice.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
So do you think that has something to do with the fact that they've managed to overcome?
Yeah, I do. I think they've deprogrammed themselves, or as we say in the book, like they've come out of the closet, right? We're all in a closet of shame of one sort or another.
Right.
It's not just gay people who have to get, you know, come out of the closet. We all do in some way. And in some way, and I say this with you know, a huge amount of respect for the gay community, but in some sort of silly ways, it's actually harder if you're straight, because it's easier to go through life pretending you're normal.
Right.
You know, whereas if you're gay, like, you're gay, you know, and you just got to deal with it. And you're going to have to, you know, unless you're willing to pay a huge cost in all sorts of parts of your life, you're going to have to deal with that. And your friends are going to have to deal with it, and your family, and you got to, you know. Whereas if you're straight and you're, you know, kinky in some way, you don't really have to deal with that publicly at all, you know. You don't even have to deal with it privately. You can be your dark, deep little secret. but then you run a higher risk. You know, I mean, it's like a gay guy who marries a woman before he comes out.
Yeah.
You know?
My last stepdad.
Really?
Totally.
Oh. He's out now, though?
He's out.
Yeah, yeah. So it kind of fucks up the marriage, you know.
Yeah.
It's a bit of an issue.
Yeah, it fucks up the marriage.
Yeah, yeah. Although not always. There's a great book called Conundrum by Jan Morris, who's a famous travel writer, okay? I loved her books long before I knew her story. Her story is that she is one of the first people to have a sex change operation in the 70s.
Whoa.
In Morocco.
Whoa.
And that was the only place you could do it. And before having the sex change operation, his name was James Morris. He was in an elite division of the British military and then he became a journalist. He was the journalist who first told the world that Sir Edmund Hillary had climbed Mount Everest because he was at base camp
in
Nepal. Right? Then he goes and, like, I've always been a woman and there is this operation people are doing. Goes and has the operation, becomes Jan Morris, goes on to become one of the most famous travel writers in the world.
Wow.
And stays married to the same woman.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. So it worked.
In their case, it worked. But, you know, huge amount of transparency and communication.
Well, see, this is the thing, man. And I think it really does tie into the idea of not just wiping your ass with toilet paper. Because I think it's a form of hygiene that we're talking about here, which is that it's like there's a form of sexual hygiene that comes when you clamber, climb out of whatever fucking closet you're stuck in.
Right.
You suddenly, there's a solvent effect that comes from just being honest about whatever your kinks happen to be or whatever the thing is that you're into.
Right.
But it takes a lot of guts and courage to not do that. I think, wouldn't you say that, if you could just throw out a random percentage, what would you say is the percentage of people in this country who are, like, sexually repressed? Is that a statistic anybody's got?
I'm just going to say 69 because it sounds right.
Yeah, man. Don't you think that we're fucking up over here, man? Like, when you look at that, what's his name? Who's the guy running for vice president?
Paul Ryan.
I don't know, man, but he seems like that guy is, like, something about him seems so fucking hung up sexually, tied up. Romney too. They all seem so fucking square.
Yeah.
And it's spooky, man. Yeah. It's like those are the people who press the fucking button to launch missiles. The ultimate phallic symbol, man. Those are the people who are going to want to jizz atomic radiation all over the fucking world, man, just because they're so hung up.
Yeah, they probably think a lot about their vital bodily fluids.
Is that a sign of...
Well, you reminded me when you're talking about the, you know, the rockets and jizzing and all that was, what was the movie? How Stanley Kubrick...
Dr. Strangelove?
Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah.
Right? Remember there's that general's always going off on his vital... They're coming for our vital bodily fluids. We've got to stop them. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, sexual repression is a huge thing. But, you know, you were talking about shame earlier, right?
And yes.
Shame is... You know, if you look at things from the perspective of, you know, like, I look at societies as organisms.
Yes.
Right? Like an anthill is itself an organism.
Right.
Right? You can kill lots of ants and that anthill continues.
Sure.
Right? Corporations, they're organisms.
Yep.
So just like we've got millions of bacteria in our bodies that we would die if they weren't there. They've got completely different DNA. Each of us is a community, right?
Yes.
Each individual. So you can break this down in all sorts of different ways. So, but if you look at things, you know, in terms of the society being an organism that needs to control people, shame is a fantastic way to control people.
Huh.
And in the Western world, in these desert-based religious traditions, which is, you know, Judea, Christian, Islam.
Not Islam. We love Islam.
They've all got a lot of shame, right?
Yes.
And the Christian, you know, we're born, what's the word? Original sin.
Yes.
Like, you are born already fucked up.
Yep.
You're already in a hole, you know, that you'll never dig your way out of.
Yep.
Perfect. Great for mind control, man. You know, shame. Your body's ugly. Your nakedness is ugly.
Yes.
Your deepest thoughts are ugly. God sees them all.
Yes.
You can try to hide, but you can't. You know, he's going to see them.
Ugh.
Yeah, great way to control people.
Yeah, right.
You know, you just plant a hook right in them. It's a deeply placed hook.
And is that a hook that you think gets placed in people in, not just in from governments, but in like relationships and long-term relationships, that one person smacks that hook on the other person by making them feel ashamed of what they want?
That's the thing. I mean, you know, in Sex at Dawn, we talk about how, you know, the war between the sexes, that's like a dog fight. You know, those dogs have nothing against each other.
Right.
You know, I mean, to get back to Muhammad Ali, when they wanted to send him to Vietnam, he said, no Viet Cong ever called me a nigger. Why should I go to Vietnam? Why do I have against them? You know?
Right.
One of the many, like, really admirable, articulate things he said in his life. Same thing. There's no reason men and women need to be in this death struggle over sexuality and relationships. The reason we are is that we're in this context where, because of misogynistic political and economic policies, women, especially American women, can't deal with having a kid and raising a family without a guy to help them out economically, and not just economically, taking care of the kids and dealing right. with all the domestic stuff. But that's predicated upon this idea that the nuclear family is the natural way to have and raise children, and that's right. bullshit. That is simply not true, right? So if we were raising kids the way we evolved to raise kids, which is in, you know, groups of 100, 150 people,
right.
everybody's taking care of everybody's kids,
yeah.
that's a whole different situation. Sexuality doesn't need to be exploitative.
Right.
Right? The way it tends to be in Western societies. And you see that reflected in Scandinavian societies that have much higher levels of economic and political equality for women. They're more relaxed sexually.
Right. And this is, okay, I see what you're saying. But it's, you know, because I think a lot about the things that you've written, and I consider, you know, just for thought experiments, you know, if you could press a button and make that happen, where suddenly I was a member of a 100-person tribe, I don't know how enjoyable that would be. There's something so delightful in being a recluse or being able to sort of be by yourself, that it feels like the idea of being in some kind of modern, large community would be really hard to deal with.
Yeah, well, anything different from the conditions in which we were raised is going to be difficult.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, if you're born and raised in Midtown Manhattan, living in Hawaii could be difficult.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
But... And it's true that in hunter-gatherer societies, there's not a lot of privacy.
Right.
That's definitely true. But the sort of the need for privacy is something that we were raised with, like this idea that wiping your ass with dry paper makes sense.
Right.
You know. So what I try to do is what Joseph Campbell called detribalization, which is try to get outside of whatever tribe I was born into. And look at things in
cool.
a more global sense.
Yeah.
You know, like that's one tribe among many that my, and I agree, I'm the same as you. I like a lot of alone time. I like a lot of individuality. I mean, I've never been to Burning Man. You know, I've never been to a Grateful Dead concert.
Right.
You know, a lot of my friends are into that stuff. I'm uncomfortable in a group of people like me.
Right.
You know, I'm fucked up in that sense, right?
Yes. I mean,
there's a personal story behind that. But, you know, I always moved as a kid.
I see.
I was always the new kid in school. I was always the kid nobody knew, eating alone in the cafeteria. You know, that was my...
So you like that feeling.
Well, I adapted to it.
Yeah.
And I turned it to my advantage as best I could. And that's why, you know, now people ask me where I live. I don't know what to tell them. I don't know where I live. I've got an apartment in Barcelona that a friend is renting. I've been in Vancouver for the last 6 months. At the moment, I'm house-sitting for friends in Topanga Canyon. In 2 months, I have no idea where I'll be.
You're a nomad.
I'm a hunter-gatherer, yeah. Yeah, I'm sort of a modern hunter-gatherer.
Yeah, which is, I think, awesome, as long as it's not bothering you. You know, some people I know yeah. who do that, they long for the stability that comes from right. having their own bed, and that's right. really important to some people. Yeah. But
I sleep on the floor.
You don't mind at all. You like it.
Yeah, I like it, and when I'm... when I am in one place for a while and I start accumulating possessions, it makes me nervous.
Wow.
I'm 50 years old. Check this. I'm a 50-year-old American man. You know, grew up listening to Bruce Springsteen and the rest of it. I have never owned a car until 6 months ago when I bought this one.
Wow.
Just to drive to Vancouver and back. I'll sell it in a few weeks. Never owned a car, never owned a house, an apartment. You know, I've never owned, I mean, my laptop is all I really own.
Yeah, this is, you know, this goes back to what you're talking about the nuclear family. This goes back to the there's this idea. What's the idea? The idea is, here's what you do. You go to school in one place. You learn a trade, or you go to college. Then you get a house. You get a wife. You hatch some babies. You raise the babies. Put the babies into the system. Then the babies bury you.
Right.
That's the mode of Western life, right?
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
See, and that is a really crazy cult. It's a cult. And that's why I've been having this fantasy lately of how awesome it would be if, like, I woke up in the middle of the night and I've been taken to some kind of, like, rehabilitation center where they're like, listen, man, I'm sorry, but you were in a terrible cult. And they had you convinced of some fucked up stuff. Like, it's okay to kill people in war. And, it, you know, they made you believe that, like, the most important thing is to make money, like this stuff that you're really into, man. It's just paper, dude. And like, wow. You know what I mean?
That'd
how awesome!
Would, movie.
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool? Like, yeah. Something just to like get you out of the fucking deep, deep hypnotic trance of the society we're in, because it is fucking heavy. Yeah. You know, they talk about there's this effect that astronauts report where they get into orbit around planet Earth and suddenly they experience this bizarre psychedelic euphoria that comes from, yeah. And sometimes I wonder, is there some component in the gravitational field of this planet that like is pulling us down or making, not I mean, literally it is pulling us down, but I mean like, you know, in some, is there some other invisible gravity, undiscovered gravity that's making people get stuck in the behavior patterns that we think are culture? And when you get off the planet, all of a sudden you're released in some way from it. I don't know. It sounds like tinfoil, tin hat bullshit, but it's like the what I'm getting at here, man. And it all goes back to the oppression of guilt. It all goes back to freeing yourself from whatever closet you happen to be in. Is that we all seem to be brainwashed to believe that there's one way of life that's right.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Although we do live in a more multifaceted world than most people ever have, right? I mean, someone in the Middle Ages, getting back to the stinky Middle Ages, you know, they would not leave, they wouldn't go 10 miles from where they were born in their whole lives. And so they certainly weren't seeing, you know, what's going on in France or Italy, and
yeah.
They weren't going to Thai food restaurants. So there is more exposure to other cultures now. But you're right that any culture still is very insistent on its own way of doing things. Interestingly, there's so many parallels between the Muslim world and the religious right in the U.S.
Yeah.
And one of them is this insistence that our way is the only way, you know, that our way is the right way.
And, yeah.
And America and Islamic societies are, as far as I know, the only two places in the world where kids are forcefully indoctrinated in this idea of certainty. Of, you know, I grew up hearing America is the best.
Yes.
America is the greatest country that's ever existed in the face of the earth.
Yes.
And da 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 da. And I look around, it's like, well, why is everyone so fucking pissed off then?
Huh.
Why is everyone so angry? Why are these guys sleeping in the street and begging for money if America is the richest, most wonderful? You know, and then I went and lived in Europe for 20 years, and after traveling around the world for 15 or so. And, you know, now I see these people saying, well, Barack Obama wants to, you know, turn this into France. Have you fucking idiots ever been to France? They live pretty fucking good over there. Better than you do in your trailer park, man.
If Barack Obama came out and said he wanted to turn the United States into France, I would be in line to vote for him. That would be the first.
You know, or like, let the Dutch invade and take over. Please, let us, you know, submit to our Dutch master.
It sucks, man. Why is there not some liberating, conquering force like the United States that drops in throwing joints to the people and exactly. great fucking fruit and good exactly. food. Yeah. It's like, why the fuck or why don't we get to be liberated? God damn it. It's yeah. like, it sucks. But
this is treason, you know?
Oh, I know. And that is, you know, of the one thing that we can say for sure about the United States, and one of the wonderful things about it is that two people like us can get on a podcast and say these things with spew bullshit with zero repercussions. Whereas in other countries, there's a, you know, you do this podcast and 2 days later, you're going to be in a fucking prison camp.
There's a knock at the door.
Yeah, there's a knock at the door. So,
but that, not in France. You can say whatever you want.
Not in France. There are, of course, other countries that embrace freedom of speech. But I want to talk about the real religion, man. Like, everyone's... you know, up in arms over Islam right now because of the hordes that are, or the alleged hordes that are attacking embassies.
Right.
And if you go and do a very, very quick internet search, you can immediately find the number of civilian casualties resulting from the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. You'll find that the United States is far more dangerous than Islam when it comes to body counts in the world. And it's amazing to me that so many people, including Dawkins, including people that I have some respect for, because Dawkins has been on a tweet rampage against Islam. But it's like, man, yeah, of course, it is a repressive religion and it's terrible. But how are people not up in arms over the fact that our country is responsible for the deaths of easily 130,000 innocent people in the last decade,
yeah.
138,000 people. And then people who are in that part of the world, we marvel at how angry they are at us.
Why are they so angry? They must hate freedom.
Over one fucking video, one shitty green screen video, they're riding. No. Come on, man. Yeah. Do you really think that's why they're riding? They're riding because we've been fucking bombing them.
Right.
So I want to talk about the real religion that exists on the planet. And it's a religion that no one wants to accept as a religion. And it's the religion of capitalism. That's the fucking religion, man. That's what people are engaged in right now. That's what people are worshiping right now. And if that's a dangerous fucking religion, right? That's the most dangerous religion that's ever existed on the planet. And it has ceremonies. It has traditions. It has the ceremony of going to work. What a wonderful ceremony that is. Yeah. You wake up and you put on your robes. You put on your
suit.
Robes,
right.
The ceremonial
outfit. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you get in your car and you join the initial ceremonial dance. And what is that dance? It's called driving down the interstate in a weird metal machine, right? Mm-hmm. And now you're engaged in the initial part of in the same way that those evil Muslims bow down on their prayer robes. You sit down with your fucking hands in front of you, stretched out towards the direction of your fucking altar, and you go to the altar, and then you sit and you go through this terrible ritual where you are literally converting your life's energy into green bits of paper with Egyptian symbology on it. That's the fucking religion we're engaged in, man, and no one's talking about it.
Yeah.
And people say, you know, oh, but look at the price when you what is it called, an apostate? When you reject Islam, the price is death.
Yeah.
What the fuck happens when you stop working?
Right.
Here in the United States, what happens when you stop going to that shitty job?
That's right. And you got Mitt Romney just yesterday getting caught saying 49% of the people think they're entitled to food. Like, how dare they? You know,
yes!
they don't want to. And I love that Mitt Romney's wife went on the 60 Minutes or whatever and was talking about what a generous man he is. You know what? There's no one on earth who's worth $250 million who can be described as generous.
No.
Because if he was generous, he'd be a guy who had given away $250 million or
that's
$249
right.
million. Oh. Keep a million. You know, why
not?
But you're not generous if you got $250 million. I don't give a shit. You know how many symphonies you've contributed to for the tax deductions, you know?
I know you are
fuck
not
that.
Fuck that. You are not generous. You're a sociopath,
right,
who's managed to completely shut your eyes to the reality of life on earth. If you're hoarding away that much fucking energy.
And what's capitalism, getting back to your metaphor? What is capital? Or it's not even a metaphor.
It's a religion.
It's not a metaphor. It's true. What is, you know, what is it that we're worshiping? It's not just money. It's the destruction of the planet.
Yes.
Right? Well, most of the people who make most money do it by fucking up the planet.
Yes.
In one way or another. Dumping their shit in the river, dumping their shit in the air, you know, creating the mountains of plastic or whatever it is. I recently read a great thing that ties directly into this. It was a British film company went to Papua New Guinea to do a documentary on the, you know, the Stone Age tribes of Papua New Guinea. And while they were there, one of the guys they were living with said, you know, we'd like to come and see where you live. Why don't you take us back to your country All and right. show us your thing? So when the producers got back to England, they talked to the money guys in the company, and they were like, yeah, why not? That would actually be a good show. Bring them here yes. and show them the marvels of the modern world. So the guy who was talking about it, I linked to this on my Facebook fan page, Sex at Dawn fan page recently, if someone wants to check it out. I can't remember the name right now. But so the guy went, he was worried that if they brought these people from the jungles of Papua New Guinea to London, they'd never want to go back because they'd see toasters and microwave yeah. ovens and be like, fuck that. So he went and talked to some anthropologists about it, right? And the anthropologist, he talked to three different anthropologists, I think, and each one of them laughed in his face. And one of them said, I can't believe how arrogant you are that you think that someone's going to come here and want to like abandon their entire
yeah.
way of life because yeah. of the wonders of London, right? So don't worry about that. So they went and got these guys, brought them back to London, and housed them with a family, right? And after a couple of days, one of the natives, we'll call them for lack of a better word, said to, they were having dinner, and he said, you know, I notice every morning, talking to the man, every morning you leave really early and you come home really late, but every day, where are you going? And the guy said, well, I'm going to work. And he's like, work? What, really working? You worked a lot. And he said, why? And the guy said, well, I have to pay for the house. And he said, really? And the Papua New Guinea guy says, really? How many weeks do you have to work to pay for your house? And the guy said, 30 years. And he said, what? Like, I need a house. My friends, we all get together. We build a house. It takes 2 weeks. I've got my house.
Yeah, right.
Like, you work 30 years yeah. to pay for this little house?
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yes. See, here's the thing, man. That's a beautiful example of what the problem is, because let's think about one of the most awful things in recent history that happened on the planet, which is the Holocaust. And it's an example that shows the world that things can go not just bad, but bad beyond comprehension, bad beyond anything that someone prior to the Holocaust maybe could have even invented bad, where someone's just doing experiments and cooking people because of their race. So who's to say that didn't already happen and that we're the result of that happening? In other words, who's to say that this way that we're living right now would be as terrible as what it would have been like if Hitler had conquered the entire planet and managed to rewrite history so that no one really understood what happened to all those Jews. And so that no one, and if you do know about Jews, then you just think of them as kind of like a time when there were some very evil people on the planet that had lost their humanity and got taken care of. So in the same way, who's to say that this modality that most human beings are existing in, where you, like you said, you spend 30 fucking years paying for a house that you can't live in because you're always working.
Right. And then through no fault of your own, people like Mitt Romney and Wall Street assholes tank the economy and you get foreclosed on.
Yeah.
You know, you can't even stay in this house because now it's worth half what it used to be and you haven't done fucking anything wrong.
They just nabbed it. They right. nabbed your house.
They just took the value right out of it, right out from under you when you were asleep.
Yes.
And now they've got the money in the Cayman Islands and you're fucked.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, man.
That's
like,
what happened.
So this is the question. Like, how, like, we can't understand how terrible the cult that we happen to be living in is. Because we were born into the cult.
Well, you know what? You what the scenario you're describing is exactly the way I see the world, actually, as depressing as that sounds.
Yeah.
There has been a genocide of Native people all over the world.
Right.
Right? So what you were just describing is sort of the way a Native American could look at reality.
Right.
Right? Like those fuckers, they came in, they murdered everybody.
Yep.
They've got this bizarre death cult.
Yes.
These white people.
Yes.
They kill everybody. They kill everything. They fuck up the land. They fuck up the plants, the animals. They're spewing poisons everywhere. They're fucking up themselves, but they just keep reproducing and spreading like a fucking cancer.
Yes.
And, you know, and they've relegated us to these tiny little impoverished, you know, places. And now we've got casinos. Thanks a lot. You know, those few of us who've survived, but
yes.
Our entire way of life is destroyed, right?
Yes.
And they, you know, make fun of us in their, you know, their movies, and the, you know, they explain the cowboys and Indians. Always the Indians were the bad guys.
Sure.
All they were trying to do was say, leave us alone.
Yeah.
You know, the Indians weren't like, you know, riding into New York to kill people, you know?
Right.
They were staying where they'd always been.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, even when someone talks about the Holocaust, I'm always tempted to say, that's just one Holocaust. There
yeah.
are many Holocausts. You can go to Cambodia and talk about a Holocaust. You can go to, you know, Rwanda. You can go to North America, Central America, mm-hmm. South America.
Yeah.
There are Holocausts going on all over the place.
Yep.
And, you know, as much as I agree with you that there were unique qualities of the Nazi thing, one of the more unique qualities is that Jews are white.
Right.
You know? The American Indians aren't white, so it's easier to kill them and forget about them.
Yeah.
You know, and there were even debates as to whether American Indians were human. Bartolome de las Casas was debating in the Vatican with Sepúlveda. They had this whole intellectual debate, like, do we really need to treat them like people? Do they really have souls?
Wow.
You know, and there was this famous debate, which de las Casas won, arguing that, yes, they are human, so they do have some rights. But, of course, you know, no one in... In practice, nobody dealt with that.
Can you imagine two fucking honkies in the middle of some satanic corruption of Christianity?
Yeah.
That's think if there truly was a historic Jesus,
right?
And you went back to before he got nailed up, and you're like, hey, guess what? At one point, your followers are going to be arguing over whether or not
right.
humans are humans, so they could decide whether or not to kill them,
right? Yeah.
That is so vile. So this is the thing, man.
So you're right. I mean, just to wrap it up, I think you're absolutely right that we are descendants of the exterminators.
Yes. So what do we do? This is the big question. This is something that I always, you know, I'm pretty good at working myself up into a shrill, you know, into a
lather.
A shrill hippie lather, you know. But I always end up, you know, outside of thinking, okay, well, I know I can improve myself, and I know I can educate myself, and I know I can try to separate myself as much as possible from, you know, the poisons of the world. But still, what are some actions people can take to move in the direction of not being descendants of exterminators?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Damn it, you always say I don't know.
I don't. One of my favorite quotes is respect the man who seeks the truth, flee from him who claims to have found it.
Ah, that's great.
You know? So, you know, I try to be upfront about my personal biases and my own areas of ignorance and everything. You know, in my own life, I think one of the most impactful decisions I ever made was the decision not to have kids.
Right.
Right? Because what does that do? It liberates me from a lot of the things that tie me into that mentality.
Yep.
Right? I don't have to get up and go to work every day.
Yep.
Because the only person I really need to take care of is myself.
Yep.
And I can live on next to nothing and have for a long time. You know, a kid, you have a kid, you've got to educate that kid to live in the world that exists, not the world you wish existed.
Okay.
You know, I think it's very unfair for the sort of, you know, hippie idealistic parents to say, oh, no, you know, I'm not going to give my kid vaccines. I'm not going to teach him, you know, you're not going to let him play cowboys and Indians. I'm not going to let him, you know, play basketball with his other kids and all that, you know, because then he wants Nike shoes that cost too much. And I see where you're going, but... you know, that kid has to deal with those other kids, right, you know, who do care about the Nike shoes and do want to watch shitty television shows so they can talk about it at school. So, you know, you have kids, you're making a compromise with the dominant paradigm that you've got to participate.
Right.
So in my case, it's like, I'm not going to participate. I'm not going to be tied down to a job I don't like just because I got to pay for this kid's education, right, yada, yada, yada. And at base, for me, the number one problem is overpopulation. I even think, and this is something I'll be writing about in the next book called Civilized to Death, right? Cheerful title. which is about exactly what we're talking about. It's about how civilization is driving us away from the very things that make human life worth living.
Right.
Right? And that's why we're so fucking miserable. You know that great Louis C.K. bit he did on The Tonight Show? Where he's talking about sitting on the plane and the Wi-Fi goes out.
Yes.
And the guy's like, oh, this is bullshit. And Louis's like, dude, you know, you're sitting in a chair in the sky, right? You know, and the Wi-Fi goes out and you're pissed off.
Yeah.
And so the
it's bouncing to a satellite and coming back. He says, what, is the speed of light not fast enough for you?
So the line he says is, you know, these days everything's amazing, nobody's happy.
Yes,
that's the germ of this book. I should be writing today, but the point. What the hell was my point?
Well, I don't know.
Oh, not having kids. The idea is there's like a conservation, you know, like conservation of energy, right? There's
yes.
a certain amount of energy or water. I didn't know this. There's a certain amount of water that exists on Earth.
Yes.
That's always existed. There's never more, never less. It's the same water cycling through over and over
Whoa.
And over. So the water you drink today has definitely been through dinosaurs. It's been through the bodies of medieval stinky people.
We're drinking dinosaur piss when we drink water.
And Roman piss and Greek piss and, you know, what, African piss. It's the same water that just keeps going around and around and around.
Isn't that wild? Is wild.
Water is never made or destroyed.
Wild.
Yeah. So anyway, I think there's like a conservation of quality of life effect as well. So if you've got a million people on Earth, man, they live really well, right?
Yeah.
Because there aren't enough of them to really fight over anything. They're spread out as much as they want to be.
Yes.
They come together when they want to come together for their, you know, seasonal rituals or whatever.
Yep.
But when you've got 6 billion people on Earth, that quality of life has to be split up among 6 billion people now. And some of them are taking a lot, and there's not much left for the others.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm not saying it's a mathematical, you know, it's not a pure, it's a metaphor. But I do think that the more people there are on Earth, the less quality of life is being distributed to each of us.
Yes, that is absolutely true. And also, what you just said is really, I think, the crux of the problem of our age, which is there's some obvious stuff going on. And the number one obvious thing is there's a very small group of people that have all the stuff.
But you know what? They're no happier than the rest of us.
Right.
That's the real tragedy.
They're no happier than the rest of us. They're fucking maybe less happy. Maybe they don't even know. They're just wild with madness. They don't even know, or they're bored, or they're just like scraping. They're like cutters. They're trying to just gratify their senses, thinking it's going to satisfy them, and it never does. We don't even know. We'll never even know who they are, because they're.
Well, I've known some of them. I mean, I'm not talking about Mitt Romney, but I worked in New York. I worked in the Diamond District.
Wow.
This was a weird time in my life. I'm not Jewish. I worked and lived on 47th Street between 5th and 6th.
Wow.
Everyone's Hasidic Jew except me.
Wow.
Right? Weird scene. But anyway, so I knew some people there who were worth $20, $30, $40 million.
Yeah.
Right? And I remember talking to one of them. He was the father of the guy I worked for. And the guy, he was worth easily $30 million.
Yeah.
He used to come into the office every day, sit behind his desk in an office with no windows,
right? Yes.
Because they rented all the offices with windows because you get more money for it. So the management office was in the heart of the building, no windows.
Yes.
He sat there and he had a business of selling hearing aid batteries. It was one of his many businesses.
All right.
And they used to give him this big pot of hearing aid batteries.
Yes.
And his job was to sprinkle them out on his big desk and separate one type from the other type, because one type had platinum in it or something that could be recycled and the other type didn't. He did the lowest level grunt work, but But he came in every day in his suit, smoked his cigars, had his Jameson's Irish whiskey, and he would just separate these batteries. And I remember saying to him one day, why do you come to work? You know, you've got a house in Jamaica, you've got a house in France, you've got, you know, private jet standing by. Why aren't you out, like, having a good time? And he said, you know, there was a time in my life when I was working for money. And then I had more money than I knew I would ever spend. And then now it's just points. I'm just scoring points in some game, you know, that you're never going to win. You know, you're just waiting to die, sorting those hearing aid batteries, making money. And that was it. By the way, just to wrap up the Papua New Guinea.
Yes.
They were not impressed by London.
I'm sure.
They took one thing back with them.
What? AIDS? Herpes?
Smallpox infected blankets. Here you go. Have a good trip. One day they took them to an archery range.
Yes.
You know, because they were interested in bows and arrows. And they saw the short arrows in Papua New Guinea. They had these long arrows. And the short arrows with feathers on them. And they were like, whoa, what's with the feathers? Why do you have feathers? And the guy was like, yeah, the arrow flies straight. Really? Wow, they're really... So they
that's cool.
The feathers on the arrow, that was the one thing they learned in
something that is so old, like one of the oldest things. Not exactly. Electricity,
right?
Nothing. No iPhones, interest in light bulbs. Right. Just like arrows.
That's a good
fucking
idea.
Cool.
Yeah,
man. Well, you know, I think that there has to be an alternative to this. And something about the conditioning now makes people think that there's no alternative. And anytime anyone starts talking about the alternatives, they're generally labeled with some pretty awful labels. Like they'll be called a communist.
Or a podcaster.
A podcastist. They'll be called a communist. They'll be called a socialist, which is really bad. But to me, I think that the problem here... And the thing nobody wants to face, the looming war that's going to happen no matter what. I think there's a looming war. I think there's and the war is either going to be between this horrific golem that we've created with our tax dollars called the, you know, all the militaries of the world joining up to try to attack Iran, to try to attack Syria. You know about this stuff, right? Of course. Like, do you know about the petrol dollar and all that? Do you know about that?
Iran's trying to extract itself from the dollar dominated.
That will cause hell to rain down on you, and that's the reason that we're doing all this shit. I saw a very concise description of it, and I'd never heard of it before, which is the idea that Nixon, I guess, separated us from the gold standard and made it so that the currency doesn't have to represent actual gold reserves, and then switched it to the petrol dollar, is what it's called, the oil dollar, and that the moment that the countries in the Middle East separate their oil from the dollar will absolutely collapse because it won't be based on anything at all. And so the reason that these wars are happening, and the reason that we went into Libya, and the reason that we are apparently in some way involved in Syria, and the reason that this shit's about to go down with Iran, and the reason there's all those minesweepers in the Strait of Hormuz right now, is because we're making moves to ensure that no Middle Eastern country separates themselves from the dollar. And if they think about doing that, then they see very quickly what happens. They end up getting fucking daggers shoved in their assholes and then shot in the head. You know, we don't care that they're tyrants. We care that they want to separate themselves from the dollar.
Right.
So there's one version of the war that's going to happen, and that there's probably no way to stop it. But then there's another war, which is the war where an organized group of people has to realize that it is inhuman for the smallest percentage of us to have the most stuff. This is not right. How is this right?
Yeah.
How is it ever right? How can you say it's right? How can you work it out on paper that it's right? If we're all on an island together, and it's you and me and 20 other people, and two of them have all the bananas, and 18 of us are eating fucking sand, shitting in our hands because you've convinced us to overcome our conditioning. How long is that going to go on for before like, wait, there's more of us than them. Why do they have all the bananas? You know, and I don't know when it's going to happen, but eventually as human beings advance more and more, and information begins to spread, how much longer are those fucking Romney robots going to be able to maintain this facade of deserving the billions of dollars that they have?
Yeah.
How are bankers going to maintain it?
The problem is that, that as the information spreads, so does lethargy.
Yes.
You know? I mean, I've been looking at the United States since Reagan, saying, where are the people in the street? Where are the protests? Where's the outrage?
Yeah.
You know? Reagan's down there, you know, killing Nicaraguans and Guatemalans and Salvadorians with, you know, illegal armies for hire that he was funding by selling missiles to Iran illegally. And it's like, oh, yeah, it's a scandal in Washington. And but nobody's in the streets. You
right.
know? You're killing, you know, innocent families in the mountains of El Salvador in my name. Where, you know, what's going on? Nobody gives a shit. The whole thing is, as war becomes more remote control and further isolated from the population doesn't care, you know? I mean, that's the problem. We are selfish, lethargic people. And that's, and the whole, you know, education system, the dietary thing, everything is encouraging that tendency because it makes us easier to manage.
Right.
You know, and what I wrote an essay about this in Psychology Today. It's called Being Dexter Morgan. And it was supposed to be about the show Dexter.
Yes.
But I tied in drone strikes and all this brilliant. Other stuff into it.
That's fucking brilliant.
Right. Because the idea is like we're against certain things, but we tolerate them if we think it's protecting us. So yes. Dexter's a good guy because he kills even worse guys. You know?
Right.
So that's why we're fascinated by Dexter. And by the way, Dexter is essentially a comic book character. He's just like Superman, Spider-Man, all those guys. If you think about it, something weird happened when he was a kid that made him different. He's raised by humans who don't really understand him but try to cultivate him in a way that, you know, like his father
yes.
channeled him and like, okay, you're going to kill shit, we'll kill bad shit, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and he's this superhero figure, you know? But what I was talking about, the drone strikes, is like war has become more and more distant. You're no longer killing people with swords or arrows or even bullets now. It's more, you don't even see the people you kill in most cases. And with these drone things, these guys are on a base near Vegas, flying drones over Yemen, blowing up cars and houses, and
yes.
then they pick up their kids on their way home, you know, from the office. It's become an office job. And I think it's going to go even further
chilling.
Than that. You know, Star Wars,
yes.
the whole Star Wars, you know, defense system, which has been this real mystery. I thought about this a lot. It started in the 80s under Reagan. Lots of money. It's always like the number one thing on the budget, but it's in the black book or whatever it's called, where they
yeah.
don't talk about, they just say, you know, $200 million. They don't say what they bought, right? We know it's a satellite system. We know it's a...
Wait. This is still happening?
It's still happening. It went right through Clinton. It's still happening now, right?
Star Wars. The Reagan
defense.
Crazy fucking lasers in space.
Yeah, yeah. They called it Tiny Pebbles is another name for it, where they shoot all these tiny little particle beams to shoot down. They're still testing the shit over the Pacific every once in a while. You'll read that, you know, they tried another. It's like shooting two bullets and hitting each other in the air, and that's why it never works, and they keep trying. That's still, they're still spending money on this.
Whoa.
Yeah. Lots of money, right? Hundreds of millions of dollars. So what I'm trying to figure out is why. What's going on? Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, right? Nobody's going to attack the U.S. with missiles. We know where they come from. We'll blow up your entire fucking country, right? No, you know, China isn't going to shoot an intercontinental ballistic missile at us. So why are they still doing this? Now, of course, one explanation is the momentum of the military-industrial complex. There are too many jobs involved, and senators won't vote against it, blah, blah, blah. But I think it's more than that. Here's what I think it is.
Okay.
We know that the technology consists of two main things. One, surveillance satellites that monitor every spot on Earth at all times, in real time.
Yep.
So they've set up this system, this global monitoring system, where they can see everywhere in great detail at any moment. You know, infrared at night, whatever during the day, they can see everything everywhere. The other thing they set up is satellites that have a launch capability for or a attack capability with nuclear-powered laser beams on board. The nuclear-powered laser beams are supposed to shoot down the missile that comes up, you know, out of the atmosphere
right.
before going back in. They're going to shoot it down.
That makes
right?
sense.
What if instead of shooting down missiles, the laser beams are trained on the surface of the Earth?
Wow.
So you've got guys sitting in a bunker somewhere that can see any place. So you say, you know, we think this guy, you know, is in Kabul on this block. Boom. Okay, we're looking at that block. What's he look like? You know, what's maybe there's some, you know, way of picking him up, face recognition, something, whatever. Oh, there he is. Boom. He's gone.
Fuck.
Guys, so you could have, you know, what, 500 guys? With those 500 guys, you rule the world.
Yeah.
You don't need an army anymore. You don't need your populace to get all excited and believe that, you know, whomever, the Jews are the enemy, we've got to go kill Jews. No, we don't even need you people. We've got our 500 guys in a bunker that can kill anyone, anywhere, at any time.
And this isn't science fiction, man. This is a fucking reality.
That's the best explanation
and clearly they've obviously this is the ultimate weapon. I mean, actually, you know, Tesla talked about having come up with something that he called a peace ray, which was based on resonance, that was a way to tune into like certain frequencies in different parts of the planet and just blow them up. You know, the Tuscunga incident, you know, when all Tuscunga. There was like they say it was a meteor impact, but a lot of people
in Siberia.
Yeah. A lot of people say it was Tesla because they asked him if he'd done it, and he said, yes, I've tested it. And like a lot of people say he was like, that was like this thing that he had been with.
Hundreds of miles of pine trees.
He blasted it. Yeah. Cause he was fucking around with resonance, you know, like if you can get shit at the same right now, this is pure conspiracy theory. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. But, and a lot of people talk about NORAD, you know, or not NORAD. I'm sorry. What's it called? What's that shit everyone's freaked out about? Not NORAD. It's called, God damn it. Those weird fields of antenna that they have, that no one will say what it is. It's called, hold on, I'm going to stop it. I'm going to look it up. It's called HARP, and it's a, something fucking around with the magnetosphere. No one really knows what it is. Some people think they're learning how to cause earthquakes, and it's like weather weapons. No one really knows what the fuck it is. But so, yes, we've got these freaks developing super weapons, which is an amazing thing to think about, which is that at any moment, you know, if like Putin is, if we get annoyed with him, somebody can just type in a couple of things and he gets incinerated by a laser. We do that in one day, and I guess you then control the planet. I mean, what's anyone going to do?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even it, just like all these other weapons, just having it gives you leverage, you know. You don't even have to use it. You could just demonstrate it like we did in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and there you go. You know, you've got leverage.
Yeah, it's to the moment. What you do is you wait for someone in another country to give a press conference about how evil the United States is, and they just vanish during the press conference.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's the kind of thing, well, because it's in a whole new dimension, like, how is anyone going to fight against that? You know, the Chinese shot down one of our military satellites about 6 months ago, and it was one of these things that was on the news, boop, and then gone. Nobody talked about it.
I didn't know that happened.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I mean, to me, the most interesting news stories are the ones that they're there and then they're gone.
Oh, yeah.
And they're washed. It's gone. So, yeah, I mean, there are other people. If I'm right, there are other people who know about this. You're talking about resonance?
Yes.
You want to hear a funny story about resonance?
Yes.
Okay, this is the last time I took LSD.
Okay, I already love it.
You mentioned Terrence McKenna earlier.
Yes.
I had been reading Terrence McKenna, and a friend of mine who is associated with the Grateful Dead got in touch with me, and he said, I've got some of this amazing LSD from, you know, the guys around the Dead, who, this guy who made acid for the Dead, and it's like, do you want some?
Like, wow.
Of course. I mean, it's like, you know, getting holy water from Jesus or something.
Wait, you're talking about Owsley.
Well, no, this was recently.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, this was, I don't know, 10 years ago or something.
Okay.
So, anyway, so I've got this liquid acid, and I've got a friend who's a psychiatrist in Barcelona who, you know, back in the day used to order LSD from Sandoz and have it shipped to him, and he was one of these guys. And so I told him about it, and he said, "Oh yeah, I'd love to try that." So he came by my place, and I gave him a sugar cube, and we put four drops on it. He asked for four drops. And then he wandered off. And a couple of days later, I talked to him. He said, "Oh, it was great. It was very clean, you know, very great." No, he took three drops. And so I had been reading Terrence McKenna and the whole thing about heroic dosages and the little green men and all that stuff. And I had done a fair bit of hallucinogens in my life, but I had never seen any little green men. And, you know, I my approach to drugs and to, you know, riding motorcycles and parachuting and whatever is like, do dangerous things safely. You know, I love doing dangerous things, but I don't like getting hurt or killed. So, so I try to be very smart about doing dumb things.
Okay.
And so I don't like do huge doses of anything. I tend to be very moderate and conservative. Sure. But I was like, well, you know, I'm not going to do this many more times in my life. I've sort of, I've been there enough that it becomes, to me, it's something to do very respectfully.
Yes.
And when you've got what you need, you sort of back off. And so I thought, you know, this might be the last time I ever do this. So I'm going to really go for it. So I took four. And I wandered off into the woods with this friend of mine. And he was really like, oh, I got to go. I got to walk. I got to walk. I'm like, okay, you walk. I'm going to lie under this big tree right here with its big, beautiful branches on this summer's day. And I'm going to lie here and look at the way the leaves are fluttering and the blue sky, little bits of blue sky through the leaves and the force of the tree. And, the, you know, and I just got really into it. And after a while, I started to feel the vibration, that sort of vibrational energy of the tree. And I could, like, bring my own brain vibration into alignment with the vibration of the tree and get that resonance. And when I felt it aligning, it was like my body would just go, and I would get this, like a brain orgasm would start, right?
Wow.
And it was so intense that I was afraid I was going to fry my brain out. So I would, like, pull out of resonance with it and, like, oh, wow, that was amazing.
Wow.
Let's see if I can do that again. And like, bring my resonance in, and then, again. It was, so I was, like, lying there being fucked by this, brain fucked by this tree for I don't know how long, right? Until I just couldn't take it anymore. And I said, okay, I gotta walk. I gotta get up. And so I got up and I walked out from under the tree, and I was walking down this trail, and I heard this humming sound. And it was like the vibration of the tree is following me, or there are helicopters, or what's going on. I look up in the sky, and right over this tree that I'd been lying under are high tension power lines.
Whoa.
I thought I was fucking nature. I was being raped by industry.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
You were tuning in to the power field above the tree.
Right.
And it was making you, like, fry out.
It was frying my brain, apparently. And that was the beginning of a really bad trip. I mean, I've tripped a fair bit, and I've had some weird shit happen. I mean, I was told once that I was stung by a scorpion in Guatemala on top of this temple, and I was tripping at the time, and a guy told me the scorpions were fatal. So I've had some bad trips.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there, just because you have to be the coolest person on earth. Because what you just said is so funny, man. I was tripping on top of a temple.
The Jaguar Temple.
In Guatemala.
In Tikal, yeah.
And got stung by a scorpion.
Yeah.
That sounds like something, that sounds like lyrics to a Rolling Stones song.
Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah, it's the worst.
Yeah.
Man, yeah. I cannot imagine that trip. That is a legendarily bad trip. That was a good trip.
No, that was a great trip.
So you were, okay. You're saying...
So wait, let me finish the other one.
Okay,
so, because I won't go into a lot of detail, but it started with that. Like, oh my God, I thought I was... You know, it's like a Thai she male or something. You know, you think it's a beautiful woman, and then you get...
Right.
And it's like, wow, wait a minute.
That old problem.
It happens to everybody. But yeah, so I mean, it was terrible. So then I was really... high, like really, really high. And I'm the guy, I'm always the designated driver. I'm always the guy who answers the phone. I deal with your parents. I'm, you know, whatever comes up, I'm the guy who will, like, I can get normal when I need to be, right? But in this case, I wasn't feeling normal at all. So I'm running through this forest. I lost my shirt. I've got shorts on. I'm sweating. I'm bleeding from all these, you know, the briars I'd been charging through in a panic.
thinking there are helicopters flying around, thinking I've destroyed my brain with all this electromagnetic fucking I'd been doing, and I'm lost in this park, right? And I hear from one direction and in another direction. And from another direction, a Spanish woman saying, "Oye, Pepe, venga aquí. Oye, ¿qué haces?" What the fuck is going on? I'm surrounded by these weird, like, voices, and then this woman. So I get under a bush. I'm hiding under this rhododendron bush, sweating, bleeding. I'd been crying. You know, I'm a mess.
This is intense.
And I'm thinking, if anyone sees me, you know, God, I there's no way I'm going to explain this. Right? Just so I got to hide, even though if they see me under the bush, it's even worse.
Yeah.
You know? But I'm hiding, and these voices are mulling around, and then the voices sort of gather, and they start moving away. So I come out from under the bush, and I come, and I look. I open these trees, and I look. There's this big field and a big mansion in the field, and there are these two mental patients walking back with the nurse. It's a mental hospital. I'd wandered onto the grounds of a mental hospital.
This is truly the worst trip of all time.
Yeah, it was pretty bad, yeah.
Like, if there were awards for bad trips well, each year...
But I'd have to... The nurse would see me and take me into the hospital.
That's the next step. That's the way it ends, right? Is you think you were having an LSD trip, and then you realize you're just in an asylum, and every fucking day...
every day.
You think you relive this thing, or you have to get dragged back into the asylum. That is a crazy...
Yeah.
In fact... What if you're an escaped lunatic and, like, you just fabricated this story and that's your escape?
That was, well, you know, there was a study, a famous study done, I think it was in the 70s, where I think it was PhD psychology students. Their professor said, here's the experiment you're going to do. You're going to check yourself into a mental hospital, all 10 of you.
Ugh.
Check yourself into a mental hospital. Tell them you're hearing voices, you know, whatever. You're feeling a break from reality. Spend the night there. And then talk your way out. None of them could talk their way out. The doctors wouldn't believe them. So the next day, they say to the doctor, no, listen, I'm a grad student. This has been a thing, you know, whatever. I'm fine. This was just a test. My teacher, he teaches here at Harvard, da-da-da. No. Nobody believed them. The professor had to go. I don't know if it was 48 or 72 hours. He had to go to the hospital and say, listen, you've got someone here. It's my student. What he's been telling you is
true.
And it was to demonstrate how helpless you become when you're a mental patient, right? When you admit you've got a problem, suddenly everything you say is suspect.
Yes. Yeah, it's the worst. And this doesn't just happen in mental asylums. It happens in fucking relationships, man. It's like you end up in a situation where the expectations have become so extreme and so crystallized that there's no way to talk your way out of it. You're always going to be the bad person, or you're always going to be this way. Even if you've changed, even if you've shifted, there's just no way out once someone's decided to allow the expectations
to... You've been labeled.
You've been labeled, and it's really hard to get out from under labels, and that's the micro tyranny that is responsible for so much of this guilt oppression that's happening all over the planet. And we don't know what the solution is for it, but it's definitely not tripping on the grounds of a mental asylum.
Do you have to cut to a commercial or anything?
No, man. We do them in the beginning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I threw a commercial in the middle of the last podcast I did, and like a swarm of complaints.
Really?
Like, Jesus Christ, man. Like, you can skip ahead if you don't like something. But anyway, man, this is going on for a while anyway, but I want to finish the story of you on top of a temple getting stung by a scorpion and thinking you're going
to have time. We definitely have
time because you can't just say the beginning of that and not finish that story. First question.
Uh-huh.
How did you end up on top of a temple? Can anyone go up to the top of the temple?
Yeah. I told you I'd backpacked around the world for 15 years or so, right? And I don't know if it's a bad idea to admit this, but I had LSD sewn into the seam of my backpack.
Not a bad idea to admit that.
And so I would go to interesting places, often at the full moon, Taj Mahal, for example.
Yes.
There's a place in southern Mexico called Monte Alban, outside of Oaxaca. And I would go to these places and often with people I'd met on the road or whatever. And in the case of Guatemala, I was with my girlfriend at the time. And, you know, sort of be there for the rising of the full moon, the setting of the sun, you know, the special kind of moment. So anyway, okay, this place is...
Were cool. You doing that for anything other than aesthetic reasons? Were you doing that because of some metaphysical idea that you could... like an astrological idea?
No. It's just, you know, when I was traveling, I sort of marked time by full moons, and I like to be in a cool place for the full moon.
Okay.
So, you know, I remember being in Kashmir in northern India on this houseboat and a lake in Srinagar and thinking, okay, next full moon, I want to be at the Taj Mahal.
Cool.
You know? And so sort of work it out. And when a cool thing about those years that I learned is that, you know, this notion that, you know, time goes faster as you get older and all that, which is true, but you can slow time down by traveling.
Huh.
A month, that month from Srinagar to the Taj Mahal is like a year in my life currently.
Interesting.
So you met so many people. You have so many experiences. Your life is so rich with novelty.
Right.
And really, time is a measure of change, right? In a vacuum, time doesn't exist because nothing's changing.
Right.
Right? So if you can pack your life full of interesting changes, you stretch it out.
Cool.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense, man. It makes a lot of sense.
Right. So if you want to live longer, have a really interesting life.
Right. Because that's when you sort of, when you get that fucking 9 hour a day job, 40 hours a week, you look up and 7 years have passed.
Right.
You're like, what the fuck happened?
Exactly.
So anyway,
yeah.
We're on top of a temple. The Jaguar Temple.
Jaguar Temple. It's Temple 4.
Night of the Full Moon.
In Tikal, which is in northeastern Guatemala, way back in the jungle.
What does the temple look like?
They are limestone temples built by the Mayans, so it's the sort of same
pyramid
style.
Pyramids.
Pyramids with very steep stairs going up the front of some of them, which they threw bodies down after they ripped the heart out in lots of them. But anyway, this one is, Temple 4 is the highest temple. I don't know how high, maybe 400 feet or something like that. To get up there, you have to it was sort of partially excavated at the time, so we had to scramble over roots and all these rocks and stuff at the base, and then you get up higher, and there were ladders drilled into the limestone, so you climb up a ladder, and then you go up some steps, and then there's another ladder. And you get to the near the top, and there's this ledge that goes all the way around.
Yeah.
And so we got up there with, it was my girlfriend and I and this other couple that we had met in the campground, because there's no hotel or anything. There was a campground, you put a hammock.
And there's no park ranger here escorting you or guiding?
No.
So you're there, you're
it's pretty
unmonitored.
Raw. Yeah, unmonitored. And she and I had taken some acid to time with the full moon setting, rising and the sun setting. And we hadn't told this other couple, right? So we get up there, and there's some other people up there, some other travelers. And what happened was the sunset, and we're above the tree level. So you're looking down, they're howler monkeys. They're pumping up their neck bag. And then it's just... crazy howler monkeys. Anyway, so you're up above that. The sun sets on one side. The moon rises. There's this big bank of storm clouds. It's raining in the distance. There's a rainbow over the green chaos of the jungle. And there's a band between the horizon and this bank of clouds. So the moon comes up blood red in this band and then starts to pass behind the clouds, right? And it's going to be another couple of hours before it comes back out. So this couple we're with says, it's going to be dark, and so we're going to go back to the campsite. So Anna and I were like, you know, we're not going anywhere for a while. We're just going to stay here. So I said, yeah, I'll hold the flashlight for you while you go down. There was this ladder that went down about 40 feet.
Sure.
So they go down the ladder. I'm shining the light so they can see. They get to the bottom. They turn on their own flashlight. Okay, see you guys later. I turn off my light. I take a step. Ah. Fuck it. Stung me on the right foot. I was wearing sandals in the jungle, like a dumbass. First of all, lucky I didn't jump, because if I had jumped, I would have fallen 40 feet on the rocks, right? And so I turned the flashlight back on, and I see the scorpion run up the wall. Like, whoa, there it is. It's about 5 inches long, kind of greenish-gray, pretty big, and it goes up the wall. And then I look, and there are more of them on the wall. So, oh, well, this is not good, right? So I go over to Anna. I say, man, this scorpion just stung me. And she was like, ooh, is that bad? I said, I don't know. Because I had been traveling all through Mexico to get there. And some regions, they can kill you. In other regions, it's not as bad.
How many hours into the trip?
This, we were peaking, right? So this was like 3 hours.
Ugh.
Right. So meanwhile, the moon's gone behind this cloud and it's pitch black, right? And you're way up, so you have to be careful where you step and all that. So, and there are these scorpions all over the walls because apparently the limestone holds the heat and they come out at night. And that's their thing. So this place is crawling with scorpions. So
how's your foot feeling? You just got stung by a scorpion. What's the pain level?
Like a bee sting, you know, like a sharp pain in my toe, right? So there are some other people sitting. There's these two Italian guys sitting off to the side. So we walk over to them. They don't speak any English, but Anna spoke Spanish. And Spanish-Italian, you can communicate. So she says to them, you know, hey, my boyfriend just got stung by a scorpion. Is there, what do you know? And they're like, I don't know anything. So, but, oh, what happened? Oh, and watch out, they're all around. So we're sort of powwowing with them. And meanwhile, this Guatemalan guy, a guard, comes up the ladder with his old bolt-action rifle. And it's his job to sit up there all night and guard against what, I don't know, but that's his job. And there's some weird military stuff going on in Guatemala at this time, as there always is, but this was kind of a rough time as well. So anyway, we go over to this Guatemalan guy, and Ana says to him in Spanish, you know, he just got stung by a scorpion. Are they dangerous? And the guy says, son letales. They're lethal.
Fuck.
I understood that. So I thought, oh, shit, man, this is going to be heavy. So.
Yeah, as in I'm going to die.
Yeah. So, but I had heard that there were some American archaeologists working somewhere in the complex. So I thought, if there's, I don't even know if there's an anti-venom for scorpions, but if there is, they would have it, right? So I'm going to get down from here, try to find them. There's no way anyone could carry me down. So I got to get myself down.
Yes.
And there's no like medevac helicopter that's going to come and airlift me out of here. I'm like 2 days from Guatemala City, which is the nearest city of any sort.
Right.
So
you are fucked.
I got to get down. I'm fucked. Yeah. So Anna starts freaking out. And you know, it's a lot. One of the things I learned that night was it's harder to watch someone you love die than to die yourself.
Wow.
She's kind of losing it. But I can't. Like, one of my, I can't, you know, take care of her. I got to deal with my shit. So one of the Italian guys says, I'll stay with her. You go with him, right? So I go down. One of the Italian guys is with me. I start making my way down over the rocks and all the shit. By the time, it's like 20 minutes till we get to the ground floor, ground level. By that point, the pain is running up along the bone in my leg. And when it gets to the top of a muscle, the muscle freezes. Right? So, like, at some point from the knee down, it's rigid. And then from the hip down, my whole leg is just rigid, right? Then my tongue swells, and it feels like after the dentist, and my neck swells, so I can't really swallow. I'm spitting. But I can still breathe, right? And I'm thinking, you know, this gets to my heart.
That's it.
I'm done, right? Or I can't breathe anymore, or whatever. And so we get to the ground, and then we start walking, and of course we get lost, right? And because it's all completely dark now in this jungle, and there are all sorts of glowing insects and worms everywhere, which is really intense. So I'm walking along with this guy, feeling, you know, this pain and this weird sensation in my tongue, and I'm saying my last words. And I remember thinking, this is so bizarre. I'm saying my last words to a guy who speaks no English, whose face I have never seen, right? Because I never shone the flashlight in his face.
Yes.
And by the time we started talking, then it was completely dark. This guy is just like, you know, it's like Dante's companion in the Inferno or something. I've never seen this dude. He doesn't understand a word I'm saying, but he's like saying, don't. And he's put his hand on my shoulder. He's trying to comfort me and stuff. And I think, I'm 27 years old. This happened the full moon of April 1989. I was 27 years old, and I thought, I've been around the world twice. I've loved beautiful women. I've been loved by wonderful people. I've experienced everything I could have possibly wanted to experience. I'm okay with this. And I'm dying in a really interesting way. You know, and when my friends hear about this, they'll laugh.
Right.
You know, this is perfect, actually. You know what I mean? I've got no complaints at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, to what extent that was the fact that I was tripping, to what extent that would have happened anyway, I don't know. But I do know that I was, you know, Kubler-Ross talks about the stages of grief.
Yes. Right?
I was Dabda, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance.
Yes.
I was at acceptance. It was a wonderful, amazing moment. And I sort of, you know, I'll write about this someday. It's like that, everything after that's gravy for me.
Wow, man. What happened, though? So you're in the, how'd you survive?
What happened was should I finish the story on my podcast?
No, you can't torment these sweeties like that. You can't leave us hanging, man. This isn't a fucking cliffhanger.
All right. So what happened, actually, it was kind of bizarre what happened. So we're walking along. We finally come to this little parking lot. There's a 10-year-old Guatemalan kid there waiting for a bus or something.
Yeah.
The Italian tells the kid what happened. The kid looks at me like I'm a ghost and says, oh, my God, come. So we follow the kid. He takes us to this hut, bangs on the door a lot. Finally, some light comes on, this like slow flickering jungle fluorescent light, you know? And this obviously shit-faced Guatemalan guy, you know, bleary-eyed, what's going on? The kid tells him, the guy says, okay, come in. Oh, it's the doctor. This guy was no doctor. He was, you know, he had a first aid kit or something, right? And so the guy looks at my foot and asked me to describe the scorpion. All this is going through the Italian, you know, translating. Yes. And I tell him, you know, 5 inches green. And he says, oh, no, that's not a scorpion. That's alacrán. In Spanish, there are two words. In English, there's just one word. It's fucking scorpion, right? There, there are alacranes and there are scorpiones. Scorpions are little red things that if they sting you, you're dead.
Gotcha.
Alacrán, which is big and green, you know, if you've got a bad heart or you're a little kid or you're really old or something, it could hurt, it could kill you, but otherwise you'll just get the symptoms I already had and in a couple days you'll be fine. Right? So nobody believes a doctor in the third world unless they give you a pill or an injection, you know.
Right.
So he takes these, it must have been aspirin and a little thing, gives me that, and he scoops some water out of a bucket and says, take these pills. And, of course, I think, you know, I don't drink water out of buckets in the tropics, but this guy just told me I'm not going to die, so I'll do whatever the fuck he tells me.
Yeah.
So I take the pills and wash them down. Then I go back to the campsite, find this, my girlfriend's back at the campsite by now and the other couple, and I tell them the whole story, and we drink beer and have a great time. And 2 weeks later or 10 days later, I start getting these really intense headaches behind my eyes. Hepatitis.
From the water. God fucking damn it. That is a bad... Look, man, I guess some full moons, you got to stay off the top of jaguar temples. Because the spirits got you.
They got me.
They got you good.
They did.
Man.
Taught me a lesson.
Well, but what a wonderful... I think, you know what, from having the experience of coming to terms with your own mortality and being at peace with that, I think that might be worth a little dose of jungle hepatitis. But, so... That's a beautiful story, man. You've had quite an incredible incarnation, huh?
Yeah.
I think even though you don't want to say you have the answer, I think one clue that I'm taking away from what you're talking about is the necessity of travel and like getting out of your comfort zone and hitting the road from time to time.
Yeah.
I got to do that. Man, thank you so much for being on this show.
Hey, I love it. Every time.
It's the best. You're amazing. You have an incredible book. I know I already talked about this in the beginning, but you guys have to check out the book Sex at Dawn. It will blow your mind and really shift the paradigm that a lot of us have been living according to. And also, you have a podcast coming out.
Thanks to you. Yeah. Last time I was here, first time I was here, afterwards, you and I went out for a beer, and you said to me, why the hell don't you have a podcast?
Yeah.
And I said, I can't. It's too much. I'm learning all this stuff. And you said, hey, I've got this guy. He handles everything. I've met Dustin since then. And so, yeah, I'm doing a podcast. I just settled on the name yesterday. It's called Tangentially Speaking.
Cool.
Because that's my interview style, which is just go off on tangents whenever they present themselves. So,
a great style.
Yeah, that'll be on Feral Audio within early October.
So early October, you guys, if you're listening to this in early October, go to feralaudio.com and check it out. I'm going to tweet it the moment that it hits the internet so you guys can listen to it.
And you will be a guest, I hear.
Yes, I'm going to be a guest on this, and I can't wait. Cool. And where are you on Twitter?
At Chris Ryan, PhD.
And you communicate with people, too, who have questions. I've noticed that you seem to be quite active on there. So
If someone takes the time to get in touch, I try to respond.
Cool. Well, how awesome, man. I can't wait to be on your podcast. I can't wait to listen to it. And I'm glad you survived that scorpion bite.
Thanks.
Bye. Okay, pals. This is I Want It Now from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the original production. It's available on iTunes. This is Veruca Salt.
That's funny, huh?
That's
sweet little pig singing.
Gooses! Geeses! I want my geese to lay gold eggs for Easter.
It will, sweetheart.
At least 100 a day.
Anything you say.
And by the way,
what?
I want a feast.
You ate before you came to the factory.
I want a bean feast.
One of those.
Cream buns and donuts and fruitcake with no nuts, so good you could go nuts.
You're going to have all those things when you get home.
No, now. I want a ball. I want a party. Pink macaroons and a million balloons and performing baboons and give it to me. Now, I want the world. I want the whole world. I want to lock it all up in my pocket. It's my bar of chocolate. Give it to me now. I want today. I want tomorrow. I want to wear 'em like braids in my hair and I don't want to share 'em. I want a party with roomfuls of laughter, 10,000 tons of ice cream. And if I don't get the things I am after, I'm going to scream! I want the works, I want the whole works. Presents and prizes and sweets and surprises of all shapes and sizes. And now, don't care how, I want it now. Don't care how, I want it now.
She was a bad egg.
Where's she gone?
Where all the other bad eggs go? Down the garbage chute.
Oh, the garbage chute. Where did it lead to?
To the furnace.
The furnace! She'd be sizzled like a sausage.
Well, not necessarily. She could be stuck just inside the tube.
Inside the... Hold on! Veruca! Sweetheart! Daddy's coming!